Finance is about driving business outcomes, achieving the business goals, achieving the strategic goals. I want my business partners to think of me as being a problem solver for them, not a problem creator.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Optimize Show. I'm your host for the episode and I'm an account executive at Spendflow. Spendflow is a unified SaaS buying and management solution that enables high growth businesses to buy, renew and manage SaaS subscriptions and save a lot of money in the process. On today's episode, I'm super excited to host Josh Rappaport, the Vice President of Finance at Acumatica. With over two decades of experience in finance, Josh specializes in driving success for high growth companies by building and leading effective finance team and processes. With a proven track record spanning B2B SaaS, FinTech, and online media, he brings invaluable expertise to our discussion today. Welcome, Josh. It's our pleasure to host you today.
Thanks, Anand. It's great to be here.
Awesome. In today's ever-evolving financial landscape, savvy teams understand the critical significance of fostering cross-functional collaboration. We delve deep into unlocking the potential of collaborative environments, exploring the essential ingredients needed to cultivate a harmonious financial ecosystem. Moreover, we'll shed light on the invaluable synergy that arises from collaboration between finance and procurement departments, enhancing efficiency and driving impactful outcomes. So let's embark on this journey together and uncover the secrets to building a resilient and interconnected, financial realm. So Josh, to start out with, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your experience as a financial professional, the organizations you've worked with, and your journey so far in finance?
Great, would love to. I laugh a little inside whenever I hear myself introduced as having over two decades of experience. Because somehow in my head, I'm still like 27 years old. So those two things don't align, but I'll go with you. I think you're factually correct. I've spent well over 20 years in finance and related roles, primarily in technology companies, big and small. I started my career actually as an investor in private equity and venture capital for the first several years of my professional life. I quickly realized that I really wanted to be an operator. It was interesting for me to invest in companies and play a small part in their growth and success, but it was really far more interesting for me to actually hands-on try to grow companies. And so, you know, relatively early in my career, I made a transition from the investing side of the world to the operating side of the world. I went to work for Yahoo, who at the time was the preeminent online media brand in what we called at the time operational finance roles, really to help folks kind of understand what those roles were. They were really what I think today we would consider strategic finance, but also today I'm seeing less delineation between kind of pure FP&A and strategic finance. So let's just say they're a part of the FP&A, the FP&A world. From Yahoo, after several years, I went to work for Microsoft also in finance roles, supporting strategic partnerships for the Bing search engine, supporting the relaunch and re-envisioning of the business model for MSN, and then made a transition out of online media over to really commerce and enterprise software for our own Microsoft online store, as well as Dynamics 365 for retail, and now Dynamics 365 for commerce. And then also I had a small stint working with Dynamics for Talent, which is the HRIS enterprise software that Microsoft builds. I think important in that narrative is to note that, through halfway through my career at Microsoft, I was in pure finance roles. I think, one of the topics we'll talk about today is cross-functional collaboration. And through my collaboration with my business partners, I was actually availed the opportunity to transition my career and move out of finance and move into product and business management and strategy roles. And that was particularly around the time that I made the switch from online media to enterprise software at Microsoft. So I went from, finance director roles to, business management, director of strategy, even product management roles at Microsoft. And I think that experience, that firsthand experience working in multiple functions was incredibly helpful for me, but also not what people think of as a typical finance career path. And we can, talk about at least what I've perceived as the benefits of that non-traditional career path as now a finance leader. And so after Microsoft, I left the 200,000 employee company to move to the 20 employee company and started my career, my startup career, particularly with two fintechs, the one in the online bill pay space, one in the cross-border remittance space. In both instances, I was, if not the one of the first finance hires, and built out the full finance organizations for both companies. And that was a very interesting experience, coming from very large, stable, mature operating companies to, you know, the typical startup environment where everybody rolls up their sleeves, does everything, and your purview is not necessarily well defined. But that's actually kind of a good thing, because for me as a finance leader, I got to weigh in on really driving the strategy of the company, as opposed to being a simple finance person. And then lastly, after a year break to spend with my family, I joined Acumatica about 6 months ago as the VP of finance, leading our FP&A team, helping support this incredible enterprise software company, ERP, SaaS company, achieve tremendous growth and continue our growth and success. So it's been a fun journey. I like to say now at Acumatica, I'm in a Goldilocks situation, not too big, not too small, and so far really, really loving it.
Thanks for giving us the context there. And it sounds like you worked for, needless to say, like the best software companies in the world, household names, with Microsoft and Yahoo. And I'm very excited that, you agreed to be on the podcast today to share your wisdom with the audience. And I'm sure they're going to reap a lot of benefits from all the things that we have planned for today. So Josh, given you mentioned that with your career path, you worked with other teams as well, not necessarily in finance, you were in product as well. So I'd say that sort of gives you an edge with cross-team collaboration, right? So let's start by laying out the groundwork. How would you define cross-functional collaboration in the context of finance, and why it's so vital for organizations?
I think increasingly, we hear a lot about modern finance as a term. And modern finance, to me, really just embodies this idea that finance teams today, in order to be most impactful, deliver a whole lot more value beyond reporting financial results. So I think to understand cross-functional collaboration within the context of finance, we need to understand that finance's role is no longer to report the past. And that's a small part of it, but not the foundation or not the fundamental role of finance. From my perspective, the fundamental role of finance is to be able to inform and enable business decision making. And it's almost always decision making that finance isn't making, is the decision making that our business partners are undertaking. And so to me, cross-functional collaboration is the idea that, we as finance professionals work across functions to set guardrails and really define the desired business outcomes. And then on a day-to-day basis, really advocate and work with our business partners to help them achieve those outcomes. I have a very business impact, business outcome-centric view of what finance does.
Understood. And while we're on the topic, can you share an example of how effective cross-functional collaboration and finance has impacted organizational performance across the years you've executed?
Sure. Yeah, I'm gonna kind of reach back a little bit in my career history, because I think, and I'm gonna talk about an experience at Microsoft, because I think it was really one of the first times I saw how powerful the finance role and the finance function was in order to achieve business outcomes. And so we have to kind of roll back, and I'll do a little bit of the inside baseball view here. In 2014, MSN, what people don't realize is a multi-billion dollar business from Microsoft. Today, people might not value it as much, but it's still an incredibly large business at a scale that, so many of my startups or the companies I advise could only dream of reaching that scale. So, MSN was really, at a crossroads, both from a business model standpoint and a technical standpoint. I think the word on the street was we were in 33 markets on 19 different code bases. So that was a technical challenge.
Oh, wow.
Moreover, we were in a business model challenge. So it was, at the time, we were developing and creating our own content. We had writers and editors. We were basically a journalism business. We're creating our own product and selling it to consumers. The challenge with that is that's a very expensive model and a model that was significantly different than most of the other businesses at Microsoft. And so, you know, the company undertook to transition MSN, first of all, get onto one unified global code base. It'll make us much more agile, allow us to do much more from, you know, a novel and innovative, you know, ad format standpoint and the like. But more importantly, we were thinking about how do we really provide the best product to our users and how do we do so in a financially appropriate, you know, way. And so we thought about, let's transition from creating our own content to aggregating the best content across all of our verticals and all of our markets. And so the idea was, well, we're Microsoft. We can do things at scale. Let's go and aggregate content from the top five publishers in every vertical in every market, which you can quickly do the math, and that's well over 1,000 content acquisition partnerships that we were working on. And at the time, I was the finance partner for the CVP who led MSN, and we needed a way to kind of define the architecture or the framework for these content aggregation deals. You had really large publishers like a New York Times or Wall Street Journal that wanted their own bespoke deals. You had really, really small publishers in a particular niche market or niche, you know, content vertical that, you know, probably didn't have the same sort of business savvy. But we needed something that we could go and operate and rinse and repeat very, very quickly. And so as a finance partner, first of all, you know, I mentioned cross-functional collaboration. One of the roles that finance plays is setting guardrails, setting the framework. So the first thing we did was say, okay, what are our target kind of financial metrics that we want to achieve in each deal? In effect, it was really, you know, what is the contribution margin called floor that we need to achieve for each deal? And that allows us to assess, you know, these were generally rev share deals, like how much revenue could we share with a publisher, or how much could we pay in a flat fee, you know, based on some pretty thoughtful, well-informed, but standard assumptions around how we would monetize content. My first job was to kind of assess the overall business model and then create these guardrails. So what are the floors for profitability that we need to achieve? And that's a great first step in enabling your business partners to go out and, in my case, negotiate deals with content providers. But that's still, like, there's still a whole lot of opportunity to make my partner's life a lot easier, right?
Of course.
So set the guardrails, set the framework. That's great. Now it's like, okay, how do I create tools for my business partners to actually go and execute quickly and repeatedly? So, you know, think of it as almost a sales enablement tool. In this case, it was probably a partnership enablement tool where, mm-hmm. you know, built a very standard model with, you know, it was robust enough that it could handle slightly different variations of a, you know, deal structure, but was easy enough and straightforward enough that, like, literally on the road, a business development person could be sitting with a potential partner and enter in with just a few keystrokes, you know, the key assumptions and understand whether the construct of the deal that they were talking about kind of fit our own internal requirements or not. So, you know, another way to enable, you know, effective cross-functional collaboration. And then the last piece of it all was, you know, bring it all home. You know, I also, or my team also orchestrated, actually I built and then we orchestrated our own internal governance process for how deals got, you know, final approval to move forward and actually get executed. And so this all sounds like pretty non-standard finance stuff. Like, you know, I didn't talk about a P&L ever, so a balance sheet or cash flow. I wasn't, you know, in today's world, I wasn't mentioning ARR at all or just, but, you know, when I think, you know, I was intentional in that because I could probably give you plenty of examples of things that sound like more traditional finance. But the reason I chose this example is because this was core finance and this embodies cross-functional, you know, collaboration, because we're basically, as finance teams, meeting our business partners where they are with their needs. It's not about, you know, I kind of have joked in my career, like one thing I really hate is finance for the sake of finance. Let's just create a bunch of financial reports because, you know, that's what we think we're supposed to do, or we're the only audience for them is internally with the finance team. There's at times there's reasons for that, but I believe in finance for the sake of the business. So whatever we can do to put our financial frameworks and our financial understanding to work in order to help our business partners achieve their goals, their outcomes, that to me, from a finance perspective, is cross-functional collaboration.
Understood. Now that is a really powerful case study of the magic that can happen with effective cross-functional collaboration. So Josh, appreciate you.
But by the way, to understand the impact of that, we executed hundreds, closer to 1,000 deals than 500 deals in under a year.
And at that scale as well, at Microsoft scale.
Yeah. I mean, the funny thing about Microsoft is it's giant, and so you would think it's slow moving, but it's also so giant that for a lot of us, we would scratch our heads at what becomes a rounding error and what becomes meaningful from a financial standpoint. So I used to joke, like when I was at Microsoft, like if I could afford it personally, like nobody at Microsoft cared. It just was well below the threshold of materiality.
Yeah, very interesting. And Josh, the collaboration sounds fantastic, right? Like you can clearly see it has benefits for sure. But we know it comes with challenges, right? People are part of different kinds of teams and different kinds of companies. Across your career, what are some common obstacles you'd say you've encountered when trying to foster collaboration between finance and other departments? And what advice would you have for other financial professionals listening to this podcast today on how they could overcome some of those obstacles?
So I'm going to use a recent example. I'm going to hope that the person who he will remain nameless. I hope the person who I'm using as an example, you know, takes this in the good spirit that it's intended. But I have a current business partner who, you know, also acknowledge that, like, I'm very new to Acumatica. I'm very new to my role. Next week will be 6 months. So this probably happened, you know, 3 months in. And I mentioned that because so much of finance's ability to collaborate is built upon trust. And trust isn't a given. You need to develop it and build it. So acknowledging that, you know, I hadn't yet had the opportunity to build the trust of this person. But we had a marketing leader who late in 23, as we're going through the budget process, I suggested, as he was working with his team and his leads, to really kind of build a bottoms up view of all their marketing activity for 2024 and cost it all out. I suggested, hey, why don't you know, I join your meetings or your conversations or one of the folks on my team who directly supports marketing. And the answer I got was, well, that feels a whole lot like, you know, the principal, you know, watching us on the playground, you know, and they're being called to the principal's office. And I had to smile and laugh a little bit because, you know, frankly, the sentiment was not surprising, but I also articulated, look, you know, I've done this a very long time. He had done this a very long time. I acknowledge that can be a perception for finance teams. I said, you know, you do what you need to do this time around. My goal, this is my goal, is that by next year's budget cycle, you're proactively asking us to join the conversations as opposed to asking to join them and being told no. And so now we kind of have a, you know, a sort of a mutual goal for partnership for the upcoming year. But, you know, I think it's funny. It's easy to think of finance people as the people who say no. And I think in a traditional world of finance, that very much was the case. It was, you know, finance with the holder of the budget, let's say, and maybe kind of finance operated a bit in a silo. But today, finance is about driving business outcomes, achieving the business goals, achieving the strategic goals. And so for me, like, it's about, you know, kind of showing interest in your business partners, you know, in their activity, what their function is. It's, you know, your ability to understand their world, really, their objectives, their challenges, you know, and exhibiting that you seek to solve their problems, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, I want my business partners to think of me as being a problem solver for them, not a problem creator. And so, you know, the old world view is, you know, finance can be a problem creator. today I want us to be problem solvers. And there's a little, look, there's a little bit of an aspect of the double agent here. Like, I'm working on behalf of my business partners, but I also need to keep in mind the full view of the financial performance of the company. So of course, everything is within kind of guardrails and envelopes that you know, hopefully we're setting and communicating and being transparent about, so that you know, we can all operate within that construct. And so yeah, you know, it's finance as the school principal. Frankly, I've been called worse. Back in my Microsoft days, I think we were going through a significant reorg or potential rift, and I think I was referred to as the Grim Reaper at one point. Oh my God. Like, every time you come by, somebody gets laid off. I'm like, no, that's not work. But you know, but perception is reality. I think it's really important to build that trust and kind of disarm that distrust in order to enable partnership. And you do that by kind of really exhibiting that you either understand or seek to understand your business partner's priorities and challenges.
Of course. And one of my favorite themes in today's episode, Josh, has been how you showed us the evolution from the old school traditional finance to, you know, finance 2.0. Maybe you have a more swanky word for it, but that has been one of my favorite themes of the podcast today. And I'm sure our listeners are going to derive so much value from hearing how that role has evolved from, you know, like you said, being the principal in the room to being, you know, cross-functional effective business partners and helping them achieve their goals. And talking about the future, how do you see the role of finance leaders evolving from here on, right? Particularly in terms of driving organizational success and further collaboration.
So first, I think it's important to understand that, you know, finance today is the language of business. Okay? And I think very much of the finance organization's role as being that of translator. Okay? And it's a slightly different kind of view of what finance does. But I think kind of there's this idea of translation, of understanding activity, let's say, that's happening in your engineering org, and being able to translate that to financial impact. There's also, you know, it's bi-directional translation. So I could also say, like, for example, like, hey, we're gonna allocate, you know, a $10 million marketing budget, and let me translate that financial language into kind of business activity, or help to translate that financial language into business activity. And so, like, what does that mean for my marketing team? Well, it's you know, it means, you know, $100,000 in demand gen activity and $200,000 in sponsorship, and et cetera, et cetera. And even going one step further, like, what would that demand gen look like? Who would we sponsor? How would we participate in events, et cetera, et cetera? So there's the translation role that finance plays. And it's typically a one-to-one translation when you're talking about an individual finance person to their business partners and their partner team, functional teams. But finance as an organization, because it's ideally an aggregation of these many translators, like, as an organization, we can act as the Rosetta Stone of an organization. So imagine, you know, engineers that, yeah, I'm and maybe I'm unfairly picking on these particular functions, but imagine engineers have a hard time communicating with marketers.
Yep.
I mean, not that I'm taking that example out of real life at any point in my career, but, you know, let's just say engineers have a hard time communicating with marketers. Well, it's finance's role to help translate engineering, it's called engineering language, to finance language. It's also finance's role to translate marketing language to finance language. Now, you know, we're as an organization, hopefully fluent in multiple languages, and it could be marketing and engineering, or it could be the, you know, HR, it could be, you know, IT, it could be, you know, any function really that you can imagine. Our role is to translate back and forth from finance to those other languages. Well, it's not a huge leap to say, if we can translate from that language to finance and finance to another language, why can't we translate from one functional language to another? And so you know, I had this concept, this idea, and I talked to my team about it a lot, of like being the Rosetta Stone, helping tie together different activity and different understanding that's happening in different functional organizations. We sit in the middle. We can really play this role and really not only collaborate with multiple functions across functions of the finance team, but help other functions collaborate with one another. I think that's really, really powerful. Moreover, as finance people, we need that centralized view. Like, in order for us to be really, really effective, we need to be able to see everything that's happening within reason. And so I say, you know, like, we have this privileged perch. We sit in the middle. We have a view to everything. We have visibility into far more than most functions have. And as an organization, it you know, finance is typically, you know, you typically get much, much more visibility earlier in your career than you would in other functions. And you know, there are many folks in finance that have as much visibility as a C-suite, but at you know, much, much earlier in their career development. I think that's really exciting and interesting, frankly. But because we have this privileged perch, we're also, you know, we need to make good with it. So it's also our responsibility to be that translator, to be the Rosetta Stone. So, you know, I think that understanding that framework, at least in my mind, and you know, I've been called crazy before, so you can take it or leave it, and if it works for others, great. But this is how I think about it. If we think of our role as really sitting in the middle, translating, tying together all the pieces, understanding, and then speaking the language of business. When we think about the role of finance leadership going forward, it's really about kind of setting forth the business outcomes that we're trying to achieve. And I mean business outcomes. Like the financial outcomes will come. But if we, you know, we talk about we want to grow our customer base, or we want to, you know, deliver more features, or we need to get more efficient with the way we build stuff, et cetera, et cetera. These are business outcomes that all have a financial impact. So like being able to articulate the business outcomes, then kind of orchestrate the strategy to achieve them. Like that is actually the role of finance now, because we have this central, you know, positioning within the organization. We use financials then as the framework, both to set expectations, set goals, and then also kind of be able to report upon our attainment of those goals and the progress that we're making. But you know, again, to me, it's less about financial outcomes and more about business outcomes. The financial outcomes will flow from the business outcomes. And then, you know, then there's a feedback loop, of course, because your financial outcomes will indicate, you know, where and how you need to deliver yet your next set of business outcomes. So it's this, you know, cycle, I suppose.
Yep. Yep, for sure. And tying it back to something you had said earlier, that, you know, trust has to be earned, it has to be gained in order to get a seat at the table with different teams. I think one of my biggest learnings from today's episode has been that one of the most effective ways to gain that seat at the table is to be that Rosetta Stone for different teams, right? Yep. Help them understand each other better to help achieve their goals and, you know, the overall business goals. And Josh, shifting gears a little bit, you know, what are your top three finance tools in 2024 that you would recommend to your colleagues that have tuned in for today's episode?
You're gonna laugh. I'm gonna betray my old person status, my elderly status. You know, it'd be kind of great if I kind of talked about some of the third generation FP&A tools or this, that, and the other, but I'm still of the age and mindset, and I'm smiling because I'm laughing at myself when I'm going to say this. My top three tools are Excel, Excel, and Excel. I still think it's you know, maybe I'm biased towards Microsoft because I worked there for so long, but I still think it's the most flexible utility out there from a finance perspective. There are other great tools, of course. Acumatica is one of them. Typically, you know, we're ERP software company, but our customers are typically more in the mainline businesses, distribution, manufacturing, construction, you know, wholesale, retail, et cetera. So not usually in the conversation amongst my technology finance peers, but I have to put in a plug for Acumatica because it's a great software. And then there are others, like, you know, for example, like we're implementing an FP&A tool right now, Planful, for our reporting and our planning. I think it's an incredible complement to the flexibility of Excel, and a lot of the ad hoc work we'll be able to do in Excel. But, you know, having our, you know, automating our reporting and having, you know, great scenario analysis capabilities from a, you know, whether it's budget or forecast, you know, kind of from a planning capability. I've been really pleased with that. And I hope to be fully up and running soon on Planful. So, you know, put in a plug for them. But, you know, I've also been, you know, let's see, I've also been CFO or finance leader of some startups, and they're like, you just have different needs. So I think kind of the best tools are dependent upon what needs you have at what point in time. And so in my last startup, like we absolutely, you know, had an environment where, first of all, we had about 200 people, but they were all spread geographically around the globe. No offices, you know, very little central planning, so to speak. And so spend became a really significant issue. And so there are two tools that we use that were great. At the time, we were using Brex for spend management and virtual card issuance and even some banking. And then, you know, a tool like SpendFlow to help us understand, like, where are we spending all the money, particularly in SaaS, and particularly with you know, consumption-based business models for SaaS. But even things like, you know, if we had, you know, we had 200 people all over the globe, and one person, you know, liked one particular software tool and another liked another particular software tool, but really their feature sets were overlapping. You know, we were very often paying for both. And something like SpendFlow helped us kind of really rationalize and understand where the spend was going and really make decisions to say, at the very, you know, I don't even need 100% optimization of our spend, but at the very least, let's not spend twice as much money on effectively the same thing than we need to. So I think, you know, kind of what tools are effective and useful are, you know, much like everything, they're contextual. I could say the same for metrics and the like. But yeah, you know, if you ask me, I just happen to live in Excel all the time. So that is my favorite tool as a, you know, oddly, you know, strange place in my heart. But there are great tools out there as well for specific needs.
Absolutely. I appreciate you sharing that wisdom with our audience, and a subtle shout out for SpendFlow as well. And my next question is a quirky one, Josh. I'm sure you have more than a few, but what is one financial jargon that you find absurd and wish you could swap it?
Oh, man. Be careful in case my private equity investors are listening. I'm kidding. Please, it was a joke. I don't think anything's absurd, but I just chuckle at like adjusted EBITDA. It's an incredible metric and really useful, and the intent of it is very, very, very powerful. But I just think it's funny, like if you read, you know, financial statements and financial reports, particularly public companies, like the, you know, everybody has different adjustments, and they, you know, the walk from, you know, GAAP to adjusted is always, you know, 6 pages long. And I think it's just kind of a funny, it's occasionally funny at like how much we can contort to move stuff below the line and get it out of an adjusted EBITDA so that we can, you know, prove that we're in fact more profitable. So I think that's an interesting one just because of how divergent the definition is by nature. Another one that very, very powerful concept, but absurd in the lack of consistency in how it's defined is ARR. I forget who it was, but it was one of the, you know, kind of LinkedIn finance thought leaders recently kind of published a list of how kind of the top 20 publicly traded SaaS companies all define ARR. And there were 20 different definitions. But I think like the idea of ARR is incredibly powerful. I think the fact that we are all able to define it a little bit differently is, on one hand, it's good because we can customize it to our specific business. But on the other hand, it makes a metric kind of probably more useful for internal purposes than it does for true comparison across an industry. So again, not an absurd, it's more of an interesting view on it. You know, I do think it's kind of absurd that we, you know, I talked about us being, you know, finance being the Rosetta Stone and translators. But I do think it's absurd that we sort of have our own language that, like, you know, virtually nobody can understand if we don't want them to, you know. But I think all these things is not to say, like, it's not to say that the jargon isn't appropriate. It is to say, you know, very much like the tools question, like the jargon needs to be appropriate contextually. So, you know, you use the language that people can understand internally within finance. If we're using finance jargon, we all understand it. We have a universal understanding of what we mean. Great. When you're talking, like, you know, I'm not going to talk to my mom about our, you know, our family adjusted EBITDA. Like, that just doesn't make sense. Although we are talking about, you know, financial planning, I just think kind of using the right terminology for your audience is important, and being able, there's a little bit of an aspect of all of what we've discussed, you know, from a finance and business partnership standpoint and a cross-functional collaboration standpoint. Like, it's necessary. It's almost a requirement these days for finance people to be a bit of a chameleon. I need to show up differently and speak differently and understand differently depending on who's in the proverbial room, very often now the virtual room. And having lots and lots of language to draw upon, being multilingual actually really, really helps. Now, I wish I were multilingual in real life. I've tried so many times. I really, you know, ironically, I really get stuck with languages. And so please don't ask me to speak much more than a few words outside of my native English. But, you know, when we're talking about business languages, I think I'm very multilingual and fluent and can, you know, use those languages for the right audiences and therefore kind of avoid the absurd jargon that may be meaningful to one audience but not to another.
Of course. That makes a lot of sense. Folks, I think one of our greatest learnings from the episode today has been that, you know, be the Rosetta Stone for your different business units. And that's a really great way to gain a seat at the table, so to speak, and of course gain the trust of your superiors and also your colleagues. Josh, that brings us to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure to host you and understand what the future of finance holds for us. What an amazing episode. I'm sure our audience will have learned about integrating a strong culture of cross-functional collaboration. Any parting thoughts, Josh, for our audience while we have
it? I want to thank you for having me, you know, giving me the platform to wax poetic a little bit. It's really been a pleasure. And I think, you know, the more I'm able to share also, the more I'm able to learn, which is you know, also foundational to being a great finance leader, a great finance professional. You know, if we can't learn from each other and learn from our peers and our colleagues, then we're not going to really be able to be great business partners. And so, you know, it feels as though I'm sharing a lot of my thoughts, but my hope is that, you know, we get feedback and comments and hear from the audience, and I'm going to get a chance to learn from them as well.
Awesome. Very well said. And guys and girls, you can connect with Josh on LinkedIn to continue the conversation. Check out the episode description for his LinkedIn and any additional resources mentioned. Until next time, stay informed, stay inspired, and keep thriving in your financial journey. Thank you for tuning in.